Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London with me, Sean Lay. And coming up in just over 10 minutes, the most recent Bond movie was called No Time to Die, and it looks like he's not dying just yet, because it will be the last of the franchise to be overseen by the Broccoli family, but it was announced today that creative control is to be taken over by Amazon MGM. I've been speaking to Bond director Martin Campbell. But before that, Donald Trump's point man on Ukraine, General Keith Kellogg, has been in Kyiv today meeting President Volodymyr Zelensky, though a scheduled news conference between the two men failed to take place. Camera operators and their equipment were briefly let into the room before being ushered out again. More on the possible reasons behind that in a moment. Ahead of those talks on Air Force One on Wednesday evening, President Trump told the BBC the stark reality, and doubtless a reality General Kellogg repeated today to his host, that, quote, Russia has the cards because they've taken a lot of territory. And on social media, he again repeated his characterization of President Zelensky as a dictator. Stefan de Keersmaeker is a spokesman for the European Union. He challenged the White House's view of both parties in the war.
I think we have a fairly straightforward and clear position on this. President Zelensky was legitimately elected in free, fair and democratic elections. Ukraine is a democracy. Putin's Russia is not.
Well, Washington is brushing aside the European view, piling the pressure on Kyiv, demanding it signs an agreement that would give the US access to Ukraine's natural resources. Mr. Zelensky has already refused, saying it provides no security guarantees. In a news conference in the past couple of hours, President Trump's national security adviser, Mike Waltz, said that Mr. Trump was obviously very frustrated with President Zelensky.
There needs to be a deep appreciation for what the American people, what the American taxpayer, what President Trump did in his first term, and what we've done since. So some of the rhetoric coming out of Kyiv, frankly, and insults to President Trump were unacceptable.
Mike Waltz. Well, Christopher Miller is the Financial Times correspondent in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, and I asked him what the political mood is like in the city right now.
The atmosphere in Kyiv is certainly tense. There's been this escalating war of words between President Donald Trump and President Zelensky over the last 48 hours. There's just been so much tension around that, around the prospect of negotiations being done by the United States and Russia behind the back of the Ukrainians. So amid all of this, Keith Kellogg got off a train in Kyiv on Wednesday morning and said, you know, I'm here in Kyiv to sit down with President Zelensky and his team and to hear what they have to say, take that back to Donald Trump and the White House, and then sit down with the president, form some kind of Ukraine policy and discuss what role the Ukrainians are to play in a Donald Trump peace negotiations with the Russians.
There is some suggestion emanating from Ukrainian sources that have been quoted by the BBC and others that the view of some around the President Zelensky is that General Kellogg has kind of been kind of hung out to dry, that he's not actually any longer central to the process of policy formulation on this subject in Washington. What's your perspective on that?
That's also my perspective, and what I've been hearing is the Ukrainians are viewing him now as someone who has a lot less influence in the White House than, say, some of the other negotiators who were sitting down in Riyadh with the Russians earlier this week. And so, you know, the Ukrainians do wonder, they are wondering, whether Kellogg is going to have any sort of influence over Trump when it comes to arguing their side to the president. And we do know that Kellogg has been sort of taken off the Russia portfolio and is now the special envoy for Ukraine only, not the special envoy for Ukraine and Russia, as had been the plan earlier in this administration.
There had been expectation of a news conference. As we talk now, nothing has happened. Indeed, the signs that one was about to begin fairly quickly evaporated.
That's exactly right. Journalists here in Kyiv are waiting for that press conference. Both Kellogg and Zelensky actually came out and shook hands, exchanged pleasantries on the fourth floor of the presidential administration. That's Zelensky's office here. They took their seat at a table. Reporters were ushered out of the room and then told only then that there wouldn't be a press conference. And our understanding from Zelensky's administration is that the Americans decided not to hold that news conference after the meeting. You know, so to us, that suggests that there are some tensions between the U.S. and Kyiv administrations, and that also perhaps there wasn't anything really agreed upon during this meeting.
What about tensions within the Ukrainian side?
I think the Ukrainians here are worried about what kind of deal could be made, again, behind their backs. Certainly, they want the president to listen to them and to carry out their wishes and desires when it comes to settling this in a way that is just and, to use Zelensky's words himself, a lasting peace, right? Well, the Ukrainians want that too. And so they don't want Zelensky to go in and to make concessions that would allow for a ceasefire to take hold without any type of security guarantees involving the United States and Europe, because the fear is that Russia would use a ceasefire period to regroup, rearm, and then invade again anew when they saw fit.
Ukraine's military intelligence chief, General Kirill Budanov, was quoted as saying that most of the components for a ceasefire are already in place. Is he kind of speaking out of turn? Is he reflecting the view within the government?
Knowing him, there's always an information war also amid the shooting war. I think he's possibly sending signals out there that do indicate that the Ukrainians are ready for a ceasefire. You know, I just said that the Russians would like time to regroup and rearm. Well, the Ukrainians actually do too. And so it's not a one-sided thing here. If there is a pause, it does also give the Ukrainians some time to build up their resources and forces, figure out how they can fill some of the manpower and ammunition gaps that they're facing right now. But also, I think, you know, Budanov is speaking to this feeling of inevitability that neither side in this war can go on at this pace with this intensity for years longer.
But is there a fear that perhaps the ceasefire and any kind of peace settlement could end up being two very different things, that the first is achieved relatively simply, but the second is achieved, but it's not something that the Ukrainians want to put their signatures to?
Absolutely. That is certainly one possibility. You know, and the Ukrainians have experience in dealing with the Russians in ceasefires. They know that the Russians have broken dozens of them over the years. And so obviously you can have short-term ceasefires without a long-term solution. And that is a major concern here.
That's the Financial Times correspondent Christopher Miller. We'll hear more from him later in the program on his investigation into Russian executions of Ukrainian prisoners of war. We've had a lot of reaction from Ukrainians to the political convulsions from Washington, D.C. over the last week. But what do Russians feel about the possible end of what the Kremlin still calls its special military operation in Ukraine? The war, as pretty much everyone else calls it, is days from its third anniversary. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg has been to the city of Tver, hundreds of miles from Moscow, to find out how the war has changed the country and whether Russians believe that the new U.S. president will help end the fighting.
Driving into Tver, the first thing I notice are the soldiers, or rather, the pictures of them. They're everywhere, on billboards, the sides of buildings, at bus stops, portraits with the words Hero of Russia, and posters of troops with Kalashnikov rifles, encouraging the public to love, defend, and have pride in the motherland. In other words, to sign up and go and fight in Ukraine. But the front line is hundreds of miles away. And so, even after 3 years of war, there are many people here, like Mikhail, a teacher, who find it easy not to think about the fighting.
Just look around. The cars are passing by, and all the shops are open, and no shells are falling from anywhere. We're not panicking. We're not hearing any sirens wail. We do not, like, head straight, not to mention run towards any, like, evacuation points. We're just talking.
But Anna thinks about the war. She tells me she knows a lot of people who went off to fight and who've never come back. Larissa says she's for the special military operation and would herself volunteer. Clearly, she hasn't so far. She says she wants Ukraine's capitulation. The police turn up, and they want an explanation. What is a team from the BBC doing in this city? How long will you be here? We show them our documents. Everything's in order. But they question our driver. They look inside our car, and they ask me to make a statement. I have to note everything down, the officer says. Suddenly, a camera team from state television appears and starts filming us. We were just passing and spotted you, the reporter says. Where have you been so far? What have people been telling you? As you see, we have a free country, freedom of speech. No one gets in your way. Do they? Well, I reply, apart from you and the police next to our car. Eventually, we're allowed to go. This little incident is no real surprise. 3 years of war have fueled suspicion of the West here. But might that change? After all, Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin are busy revamping US-Russia relations. So, what do people in Tver make of President Trump? Valia tells me that with all the talk of a possible Trump-Putin summit, she hopes for a positive result and that the fighting will end soon. But Mikhail, the teacher, isn't optimistic.
Trump hasn't got any plan, unfortunately. He is an improviser. He doesn't know what he's going to do. My sympathies are with him. But speaking about this particular episode, we are all in the dark, and Trump is in the dark himself.
And yet, by the end of my trip to Tver, I can't help feeling that for much of the time, Russians too are in the dark about the war, about Ukraine, and about the future. People express hopes, yes, but avoid predictions. Is this a sign of fatalism? Partly. But there's also here a deep sense of resignation that the most important questions, like war and peace, will be decided way above the heads of the people.
Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, reporting there from Tver on the reaction of Russians to the prospect of a ceasefire in the now nearly three-year-old war with Ukraine. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service with me, Sean Lay. Our headlines this hour: a scheduled joint news conference by President Zelensky and Donald Trump's Ukraine envoy General Keith Kellogg has been cancelled at the last minute amid widening differences between the two countries. President Trump's controversial nominee Kash Patel has been narrowly confirmed as the new head of the FBI by a Republican-controlled Senate, voting largely along party lines. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. It's the end of an era for fans of 007. Michael G. Wilson, who's produced the films with Barbara Broccoli since 1996, is leaving movie making, and creative control of the franchise, now in its 63rd year, will be held in future by Amazon Studios. Well, it's hardly handing over Britain's greatest spy to Smersh, but if not deadly, it is controversial. Martin Campbell has directed two Bonds, Pierce Brosnan in GoldenEye, Daniel Craig a decade later in Casino Royale. How does Martin think that Michael G. Wilson and Barbara Broccoli, how essential were they to the films?
They're absolutely crucial. Absolutely crucial. They're the, essential.
What was your relationship like with them when you were directing the two films?
I mean, the great thing with them is that they let you make the film you want to make. Mm. You know, as a producers, they're absolutely great. In fact, they're probably the best producers I've ever worked for, because they allow you the freedom to make the film you want to make. And, you know, as long as they feel it's within the Bond, with the parameters of Bond, absolutely fine. For a director, they couldn't be best.
Were you surprised by this announcement?
Well, yes. I mean... As I understand it, Barbara and Michael want to keep the status quo. They want it to be a theatrical experience. Mm. And I couldn't agree more. I mean, presumably after that, it would go on to streaming. I don't know exactly what the details are, but I absolutely agree with Barbara and Michael. You know, Bond is an experience. That's the point. It's a real event. And it has to go on the big screen, no question about it. It has to have a good theatrical run.
What about Amazon's involvement? I mean, I can imagine some kind of unease among some fans at the prospect of a company like Amazon, which has so many other interests, never mind its involvement, of course, in streaming. As you said, streaming isn't going to be the first place that the Bond films appear. They'll still be theatrical, but eventually they go to streaming. But do you think Amazon has the right, could have the right approach for Bond? Could it? Well, I mean, does Bond need something new?
I don't think the details have actually been made public. I know that I've read articles of Barbara actually saying, look, we want to keep the status quo. We want this to go on the big screen. We do not want it to go on to VOD or whatever that process is. But she wants it on. She wants to keep the status quo. Stick it on the big screen, right? Have it a full theatrical run. And then, like every other movie, like indeed with Bond, of course, as well, you know, you then go on to VOD and so on and so forth. She doesn't want to change that. And because these movies are event movies.
Was there anything you wanted to do on your two films that you couldn't really persuade the producers to go for?
No, we did everything we wanted to do. I mean, that's the great thing about Barbara and Michael. You know, they absolutely, this is what you've got in the script. They give you the tools to do it, and you also financially, you know, the budget, allows for that. That's the point, and they make sure it does, and they make sure you get what you need and what you want to make the movie.
You were quoted, I think, and you may have been misquoted, so please tell me if that's the case, as yeah. Questioning whether there would be another Bond at all. Do you think, in a sense, this decision makes it clearer that there is life in the old spy yet?
Yeah. You mean the decision with...
For Amazon to actually put up some money and say, we want to take this on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's not just about the back catalogue.
No. I think they... Look, I mean, streaming's all about subscription, isn't it? I'm not quite sure. Is the argument, well, you know, we're not prepared to give you the budget to do this, to make the next James Bond film, unless... We can have A, B, and C, right? I think I read that, Barbara, they don't want to do a television spin-offs or spin-off movies of it. I mean, I don't know what specifically Amazon want to do with it, but I presume they want to cash in on the whole back catalogue and any kind of, as you say, any spin-offs that they can make work. Personally, I wouldn't have any spin-offs at all. I would keep the status quo. That's what I would do.
Former Bond director Martin Campbell, shaken perhaps, but certainly not stirred. Now, Germany's election campaign is into its final days, overshadowed by Donald Trump's upending of US foreign policy on both Europe and Ukraine. Voters living in the EU's largest economy head to the polls on Sunday. Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reports now on the mood in Lower Saxony.
Mark runs a chip shop in Osnabrück, northwest Germany. He's one of the country's undecided voters. His list of worries includes the war in Ukraine, energy costs and the economy.
We were always called the engine of Europe, but we're stuttering a little. We missed out on investing in important infrastructure.
And are you hopeful for Germany, looking ahead to this election?
Yes, Germany is a strong nation. I believe we can do this, but we have to roll up our sleeves and make the right decisions so we can move forward.
But who'll move Germany forward? The frontrunner to be the country's next leader is the conservative CDU party's Friedrich Merz. Here he is debating the current chancellor, SPD Social Democrat Olaf Scholz, in their final TV duel. They sparred over the economy, immigration and the far-right Alternative for Deutschland, blaming each other for aiding that party's success. The AfD wasn't even at this debate, but the party's persistent popularity at second in the polls has been ever present at this election.
Und vor allen Dingen den nächsten Kanzler unseres Landes.
On to a CDU rally in the town of Vechta, the party's youth wing not in a shy mood.
Wir wollen friedlich mehr, friedlich mehr. Wir wollen friedlich mehr.
So we're in the middle of a large sports centre. People are taking their seats. The banners and the placards are up, and we're going to see who we can talk to.
I think that the CDU will be the party with the highest votes.
This is Henning.
Yeah, I think that they will lead the next coalition, yes.
Who's going to be in that coalition? Because there is potentially quite a messy scenario, isn't there, where it has to be a multi-party coalition. Are you concerned about that?
I'm not concerned. I think that CDU and SPD are going to do a coalition. Now they fight a lot, but afterwards, when the vote is over, they will get together and do the best for Germany.
I'm Alexandra Riester, and I'm 24 years old, and I'm a student.
Given what we're hearing from the US, the remarks that the President Donald Trump has been making, what do you think Friedrich Merz could do or would do in terms of European security in Ukraine?
What Europe expects from Germany is that Germany takes more of a leadership position.
But do you think Friedrich Merz, as Chancellor, he would step up?
This is what I really hope. But I also know that many Germans, they're still a bit in a bubble. I don't think they're aware of the risks that might await us.
The crowd cheers for their candidate, but this is the easy part. If he becomes Chancellor, Mr. Merz will have to tackle Germany's deep-rooted problems and react to a rapidly changing world.
Our Berlin correspondent Jessica Parker reporting. And just to let you know that NewsHour on Sunday, both editions of the programme will be hearing live from Germany with Jamie Kumarasamy reporting on the final stages of the election campaign and, of course, the all-important results here on the BBC World Service. You're listening to NewsHour. Now, if your climate is getting drier and you're running short of water, why not do as the ancients did and harness it from fog? Researchers in Chile were inspired by a traditional method they saw used in the desert city of Alto Opicio. The locals there hang a fine mesh between poles to capture drinking water from the low clouds sweeping in from the Pacific. Francisco Albornoz, one of the researchers from the Catholic University of Chile, told NewsHour's Tim Franks how it works.
There is a huge amount of water in the fog. In Chile, we have a special condition where the mountain range is facing the seashore. So we have about 1,000 kilometers where we can collect large amounts of water from the fog. We have these special conditions, but it's also replicable in other places of the world, like in Morocco or Spain.
Does it literally happen that the water is somehow, I mean, it's caught in this mesh, but is then somehow wrung out into buckets? How does the process work?
The mesh is facing the fog. So the fog is pushed through the mesh, pulled by the wind. And with that, we're just passively collecting water. And we have the possibility to collect about 100 liters per fog collector per day.
So it drips into a trough and you collect it that way. I mean,
exactly. And it doesn't use energy at all.
Right. No, that's a very good point. Is this water for irrigation or is this drinking water?
Actually, the quality of the water is so good that we can use it for drinking, for agriculture or any other purpose that you can imagine.
Gosh, presumably it sounds simple, the idea. Is it also relatively cheap?
Absolutely. Yeah, in comparison to a desalinating plant for seawater desalination, this is much, much cheaper. It doesn't require energy. So here we're talking about $2,000 per a fog collector. And the maintenance of this is relatively simple. You have to clean the mesh once in a while, or suddenly you will have to replace it every 2 to 5 years. So with a cost about $50, $100. So it's pretty cheap.
Are you going so far as to say that those places in the world which are, especially because of climate change, are facing increasingly dry conditions, but nonetheless are in some cases fog-bound, that they really can substitute the water shortages that they are currently facing?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, we were visiting a large project in Morocco last year as a research group. So they are providing drinking water for about 20 to 30 villages. So they just rely on fog water collection, and they are coupling their collection of water with storage strategies because they don't have fog throughout the year. They have fog around 100, 150 days per year.
Francisco Alborno is one of the researchers from the Catholic University of Chile, talking to NewsHour's Tim Franks. Now, where I come from on Exmoor in England, when it's foggy, we have very damp air we call mizzle. So I'm going to have to go out and collect some mizzle next time I'm down there. This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Sean Lay. The former boss of Spanish football, Luis Rubiales, has said he'll appeal after a court found him guilty of sexual assault. Jenny Hermoso was receiving her medal for being part of the women's winning World Cup team when Mr. Rubiales kissed her. As well as the conviction, he was fined the equivalent of just over $11,000. Spain's Equalities Minister Ana Redondo welcomed the verdict.
Un beso no consentido es una agresión sexual.
A non-consensual kiss is a sexual aggression. We cannot re-victimize the victim. And in that sense, I think it is a step forward. And it is a sentence that proves that our law is a good law. It is a law that protects women against aggression. Consent, and this is the important thing, is the cornerstone of every relationship.
Well, earlier I spoke to the BBC Women's Football News reporter Emma Sanders. I asked her what the verdict means for the women's game, not just in Spain.
Well, I think firstly it brings an end to a trial which has obviously attracted, you know, huge media attention across Europe. I think naturally people have been supporting the players and their willingness and their bravery, as Lucy Bronze, the England defender, described it earlier today. I think that's the one thing that actually the women's game more generally is taken from this is that player power and the, you know, the power of the voices of the Spanish players. But you know, we've just heard within the last hour that the Spain player Irene Paredes has just done a press conference before their Women's Nations League game, and she says that, you know, the sentence for the sexual assault was correct in their opinion. She says this is reflective of the view of the dressing room.
To what extent was this case about something more than just the behaviour of Rubiales? Luis Rubiales, obviously a powerful figure in charge of the Spanish Football Federation at the time of this sexual assault. It seemed as much as anything about what happened after that and the efforts that the whole institution made to change the story or alter how the players were expressing it.
I think that's an important thing to note throughout all this is that yes, this has been the focus of the case. Yes, this has been the focus of what the players have been speaking out about. But as you say, there has been bigger topics underneath all of it. I think one of the main things is the Spanish players consistently for the last 2 years have wanted change. They want to see improvements within not just the Spanish Federation for the national team. They want to see improvements in the domestic football in Spain. And they want to see improvements in the attitudes and the behaviour towards women and female athletes in Spain. And I think that's probably the most important thing. It's now becoming a discussion across women's football. It's not just about what is the verdict, what's the reaction. It's actually, okay, how can we change the discussion moving forward? How can we make this the norm that these attitudes, these behaviours and these considerations towards female athletes are taken seriously on a daily basis?
And do the footballers themselves believe that the Federation is committed to changing, that it's not simply the kind of things that organisations say or their PR people say when there's a big controversy or a big case like this?
Well, I think that's certainly the hope, isn't it? You know, these players hope that what they've asked for and they hope that what they've challenged will be changed. But I also think there is, you know, a deeper understanding that things won't just change overnight. I remember speaking to the Ballon d'Or winner, Aitana Bonmatí, who, you know, such a key player for Spain. You know, she was one of the stars of the World Cup, obviously the best player in the world, and she has been for the last 2 years. And she's told me in April last year that despite it being almost 12 months since they'd won the World Cup, that absolutely nothing had changed. You know, they were world champions. This case was going on. They'd spoken out. And, you know, there's an understanding that things won't just change just because this is finished. But what has changed is that these discussions are now taking place when perhaps they weren't, certainly a year and 2 years ago.
That's the BBC's women's football reporter, Emma Sanders. Our top story this hour is the meeting in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv, between the retired US General Keith Kellogg, who President Donald Trump had charged with trying to find a path to peace, and Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky, the man Mr. Trump now dubs a dictator. Well, in Washington, D.C., the president's voice may always be the one which sounds the loudest, but it is not alone. The Senate is the chamber of Congress with a constitutionally defined role in foreign policy. Yet even those who've passionately and publicly supported Ukraine and condemned Russia in the past are keeping their counsel over Donald Trump's latest overtures to Moscow. We've been requesting interviews with Senate Republicans since Monday, including with the chair of the Armed Services Committee, Roger Wicker, who's spoken to NewsHour in the past, but so far we've had no success. Seems, though, it's not just us getting the cold shoulder in Washington, as Robert Jimison, a congressional correspondent for the New York Times, has been telling me.
We are also experiencing a similar problem. I'm heartened but disappointed that it is not just me and that you guys are running into the same issue. But I do have the benefit, you know, I'm on Capitol Hill every day. And so I do try to catch the senators in between meetings coming from votes. And that's where we're getting most of our information now. There is a blanket reluctance among that group that you mentioned, those who have vociferously supported sending aid to Ukraine, even in the face of the opposition from Donald Trump before he became president again. We've been trying to talk to those folks, and they don't seem too excited or eager to publicly put out their stance. So yes, to answer your question, I've been facing the same difficulty.
You had one, I think, quite comical encounter with a woman senator.
Yes, Senator Joni Ernst. I was, as we do in Capitol Hill, there's a subway that goes between the office building and the main chamber where senators vote. And so one of the strategies is to catch them on the subway ride as they're running from the train and into the elevator. And I caught Senator Ernst, who is a veteran herself, served in the armed forces here in the United States, very passionately defended voting for aid to send billions of dollars of aid to Ukraine last year, has been an outspoken voice on the issue and has really never shied away from these questions in the past. And when I asked her, you know, how would she feel about the prospect that President Trump, you know, floated the idea of holding an in-person bilateral meeting with President Vladimir Putin, and she got into the elevator, turned and looked and shrugged her shoulders. Just no response to someone who she has, you know, boldly claimed is a war criminal, has her and her colleagues have said needs to be thrown in jail. Just, you know, the silence was deafeningly loud from her and others on the Hill this week.
I guess she was saved by the bell and the doors closing. But just in more general, what are people saying to you privately, and why do they feel unable to say that publicly?
Well, I don't think there's a huge difference between the private and public remarks. I think there is.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah,
I think there are some discontent in more, maybe expressed more aggressively or more openly in private. But I think what we're hearing in public is, like you mentioned, Donald Trump is often the loudest voice in Washington. What you're seeing right now from him, from his vice president, from his national security director, is what they're trying to push as a full court press for their Ukrainian policy. But in order for it to be truly a full court press coming from Washington, you need to have all three branches and all influential members of your party on board, yeah, which the Senate and Senate Republicans are a huge part of that. And so the absence of that voice, you know, people are taking notice. It's why, you know, it's why I've been running around the Hill this week trying to talk to people. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, is it fear or is it a case of them biding their time?
I think it could be both. And I think what we saw during the confirmation hearings, we're undergoing the process of confirming President Trump's cabinet picks, is that when people privately or behind the scenes tried to register their opposition, you'll take the Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth as an example, the North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis had issues with a lot of the allegations about Hegseth's drinking habits and allegations of sexual assault, and behind closed doors and privately tried to raise these both with the administration and with his fellow colleagues, and began an effort to muster up some opposition to this. Well, that was quickly stamped out when Donald Trump started to muse pretty publicly and to Senator Tillis directly, well, I wonder who we can run and who we can fund to challenge you in the next election cycle.
That's Robert Jimison of the New York Times. Boalem Sansal is an award-winning novelist, 80 years old and living with cancer. He's also a prisoner. For the last 3 months, the Franco-Algerian writer has been in custody in Algeria. Mr. Sansal had landed at Algiers Airport on the way to visit his family when he was detained. He's being held for breaching state security, but details of the charges aren't known. His French lawyer has still not been granted a visa to see him. From Paris, Hugh Schofield reports.
With his long grey ponytail, Boalem Sansal was a familiar face in the French media. This was him on a popular chat show a few years ago when he'd released a new novel. He was a kind of go-to guy on Algeria, not least because he was very critical of the government.
Boalem Sansal. France Inter. L'écrivain franco-algérien Boalem Sansal.
So it was a shock when, in November, it was announced that on a visit to Algiers, Sansal had been arrested at the airport under state security laws.
I am the publisher of the last book of Boalem Sansal.
Paris publisher Jean-François Colosimo knows Boalem Sansal well. He describes him as a humane and gentle person and a genuine free thinker.
Above all, he's a man who trusts in human brotherhood. He's a man who trusts in a kind of love for the cosmos, love for history, love for the different people and their cultures. He's really a man of peace.
So what has angered the Algerian government so much about him?
He's a writer of the size of the Solzhenitsyn. He says the truth about the official history. He puts it down for a kind of regime like the one that, unfortunately, the Algerian people have today on their back. Truth is unbearable.
Sansal had been getting up the nose of the Algerian government for many years. From semi-exile in France, he wrote about corruption, about what he saw as the carve-up of power between the Algerian military and Islamists, about the threat to France of Islamists. And in this interview, on a website close to France's hard-right National Rally Party not long before his arrest, he may have overstepped the mark, calling into question aspects of Algeria's official account of its own history.
Moi personnellement, ce Boalem très sale.
On the internet, the reaction from pro-Algerian influencers in France has been vitriolic, accusing Sansal of being a stooge for Marine Le Pen. The president of Algeria, Abdelmadjid Tebboune, gave an interview saying that the whole affair was a concoction intended to mobilize opinion against Algeria. The truth is that Boalem Sansal is caught up in a bigger crisis, which is the recent breakdown in relations between France and Algeria, possibly the worst since Algerian independence 60 years ago. Sansal is a victim and a kind of hostage. He's never written a word that is seditious or inflammatory, merely described the world around him as he sees it. His lawyer, still waiting for the chance to visit him in prison, is François Zimeret.
As all free thinkers, his thoughts and beliefs might have shocked or irritated. This is incumbent to freedom of speech, in fact, but I still don't see how his words could have endangered a state of 45 million inhabitants.
That report on Boalem Sansal, compiled by our correspondent in Paris, Hugh Schofield. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service with me, Sean Lay. Do stay with us. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. The German company Birkenstock produces sandals that are achingly fashionable. Their cork and latex soles have graced some seriously glamorous feet. But today, Germany's top court ruled that Birkenstock could not claim the protection afforded by copyright law because its sandals weren't art, but items of practical design. So what was the company trying to achieve when it went to court? Rosie Burbage is an expert on intellectual property and fashion at the London law firm Howard Kennedy LLP.
So a very common issue that faces all sorts of fashion businesses, including Birkenstock, are copies of their products that are released onto the market but without their brand name attached to them. And so I assume that Birkenstock has identified a significant issue, either being just damaging their brand value or potentially sales being diverted.
the court didn't see it the company's way.
Quite. So the issue there is that Birkenstock was trying to rely on copyright. And obviously the origins of copyright are more to do with artistic works. And when you're talking about something that's a functional item, particularly something like a Birkenstock sandal, which is relatively simple, it does become quite a bit more complicated to be able to argue that that fits within that artistic bucket.
I'm sure there are many fashion brands who would say, of course we're artistic, of course there is art in the product that we sell. But is it a particularly difficult thing for them to apply intellectual property protection for fashion brands?
If it was a one-off, like a couture outfit, for example, it's usually much more straightforward to say that that is a artistic work and it meets the requirements for being a copyright work. Where you're talking about something that's highly functional and is obviously sold in significant volumes over a long period of time, it becomes a bit more challenging to say that it is a copyright work. There was a case in Denmark, maybe less than a year ago, to do with Ganni sandals, and that found that they were a copyright work. I think the important distinction there was that the shoes themselves, I guess, had a bit more bells and whistles to them.
The red soles of a certain high-heeled shoe have created an interesting legal precedent. Tell me about that.
Well, that is very interesting on many levels, not least because what you're talking about there is Louboutin, the red sole, and that concerned a different intellectual property right, which is trademarks. So copyright, everybody thinks it lasts for a very long time, which is 70 years after the death of the creator. But in the case of a trademark, it can potentially last forever, provided that a fee is paid to the relevant trademark office and that there is a continued use of that particular sign. So in this case, the red sole. And for that reason, there's obviously quite a strong public policy incentive to not hand out that sort of monopoly unless there's a really good reason.
Could Birkenstock now say, actually, we're going to have a go under trademark? We're going to argue that our sandal may not be artistic and therefore it may not be copyrightable, but it is a trademark. It's sufficiently distinctive, and even better, that could be a lifelong protection.
Whether they can do that depends on them being able to register the shape of the Birkenstock sandal in relation to footwear. I don't believe that they have a shape mark for that, and they're quite difficult to obtain. But the more likely route, if I were in Birkenstock's shoes,
or sandals,
is to think about unfair competition.
That's Rosie Burbidge from Howard Kennedy LLP. Well, we began News Hour on the subject of Ukraine, and we end this edition there too with the question, is Russia allowing its soldiers to execute Ukrainian prisoners of war? A documentary called Film Me, which is on the website of the Financial Times, documents its investigation into social media and drone footage showing soldiers who've surrendered being put to death. Christopher Miller, who we heard from earlier, is the reporter behind the investigation.
So these are extrajudicial killings of Ukrainian soldiers who have laid down their arms, put their hands above their head or behind their backs, and come out and surrendered. And Russian soldiers, instead of taking them captive, as you know, the rules of war dictate, they're gunning them down, sometimes at point blank range, or forcing them to kneel and then shooting them in the back. So one of the cases that first brought my attention to what I thought was this pattern of executions by Russian soldiers on the battlefield was a case just at the end of the first year of Russia's full-scale invasion involving a Ukrainian soldier by the name of Alexander Matsievsky. And there was a video that was found on Russian social media that quickly spread across the internet like wildfire. And it's Matsievsky looking into the camera after being captured by Russian soldiers, lighting a cigarette and being asked if he has any final words. And those final words are glory to Ukraine, or Slava Ukraini in Ukrainian. And he instantly became posthumously this Ukrainian hero and symbol of Ukrainian resistance. And we managed to speak with his mother, Paraska Demchuk, for this film.
When they showed me the video, I recognized my son by his posture. And immediately it struck me like lightning. I shouted, Sasha. It is so painful to watch how he was executed, those final moments of his life.
We found and traced a Russian soldier from that brigade. His name is Oleg Yakovlev, and we believe that he is a hooded man and an executioner in this video. We traced him from the battlefield back to his hometown of Saratov, Russia, south of Moscow. And we believe that in doing so, we've shown evidence that links the battlefield executions to senior commanders and then all the way up to the Kremlin. This brigade that was involved in this was given a state award and this special guards order from the Kremlin back in the summer of 2024.
What has Oleg Yakovlev said to you about the claim you've made?
So I did connect with him over the Russian version of Facebook, VK. He did say that he did not kill them, but he wouldn't go into details. When I pressed him further, he said that he would prefer to keep the details silent and not elaborate further.
Could this not just be rogue elements in Russia's military rather than a kind of sanctioned policy?
What we did is confirmed more than 30 cases of executions on the battlefield. And we believe there are much more because these are merely the ones that we were able to view through drone footage or footage posted by Russian soldiers themselves online and confirm and geolocate and know where they took place. And the number of them, there was just a huge spike over the course of 2024. We saw a big increase in cases, and so did the Ukrainian Prosecutor General's office. And to them, this leads them to believe and viewed to be viewed as a policy.
Christopher Miller, Film Me is on www.ft.com. Thanks for your company.